Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on modern science and Noah's Ark when we come back. You know, Charles Lyell was one of the pillars of modern geology, and he published his Principles of Geology back in the early 1800s. Lyell's concepts are so widely accepted today that most people who believe them don't even know who it was that originated these ideas. But it's from Lyell's system of reasoning that a doctrine of origins has been devised by simply projecting all of the natural processes that we observe today back through time indefinitely. And in that way, catastrophes like Noah's flood have been strictly ruled out. And this process now is labeled science. Well, listen to this. Let's take a look at Niagara Falls. This famous waterfall is a magnificent example of a geologic clock that reveals a very young Earth. And that's because the rim of the falls is wearing back at a known rate every year. And geologists recognize that it has only taken about 5,000 years to erode from its original precipice. Now, what did our teachers tell us about the extinction of the dinosaurs? Can you remember that one? Remember, they told us it was 65 million years ago. But Niagara Falls only has a history of 5,000 years. Now, we don't have to be rocket scientists to do the math on these kinds of pseudo-scientific lies. And that's just one more of the many examples of evolutionary propaganda that masquerades under the banner science. And it's one more of the many lessons that we teach here in our Mosaic Law School. It's conducted twice a year here in Isabella, Missouri. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package. That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's educational, informative, entertaining, and free. And you can call and order one right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send us an email request for that free General Law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget. All right, we're talking about modern science and Noah's Ark, and I picked up the book called The Genesis Flood. Let me give you the name and number for that one again. It's put out by the Presbyterian Press. What do they call that now? It's called the Presbyterian and Reformed Publishing Company of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. It's a college-level textbook on geology. It's a geology textbook called The Genesis Flood, written by John C. Whitcomb and Henry M. Morris. And we're on Chapter 1, The Basic Arguments for a Universal Flood. All right, now I told you the other day, I went through the text, and you can read it for yourself. After all, this is a legal experiment. We're applying the rules of evidence to the text in the Bible, in Genesis 6, 7, and 8, those three chapters. We're going to use the rules of evidence, and we're going to use the rules or the 23 techniques that we use on cross-examination to test this text to see if it is judicially or legally admissible in a court of law. Now, I told you that it was, and that we did, and now I'm going to make the presentation. Now, I went through the text, and I took out 48 statements in those three chapters. I wrote them down. I'll read four or five of them to you. 48 statements. For instance, one of the statements says, all of the high hills were covered. 15 cubits, the mountains were covered. All flesh died that moved upon the earth. Fowl, cattle, beasts, creeping things, and every man, all died in the dry land. Now, those are some statements. Those are about five or six statements out of 48 that ought to tell you that this is a worldwide flood. Nothing local about it. In reviewing those same three chapters, I couldn't find one single statement that would lead me to believe, or in my view, lead any rational, normal person reading the text to the conclusion that this flood was local. Why don't you read those three chapters, 6, 7, and 8, that's Genesis 6, 7, 8, and then ask yourself, in fact, why don't you take a pencil while you're at it, just write down, every time you see a statement in there, you write it down, and you say, does that indicate worldwide or local? You know, to your mind, sitting on a jury, how would you take that? Now, Whitcomb and Morris came to the conclusion that this thing was worldwide in scope. The evolutionists now, remember, they tell us that they don't believe that there was a flood at all, period. That's the end of the report. Certain religious people say, no, we believe there was a flood and it was worldwide. And then there's this broad middle ground, and that's the one I zeroed in on, the broad middle ground of theology, trying to reconcile the Bible and science. The Bible and evolution. The Bible harmonizes perfectly with science. The Bible does not harmonize at all with theory and speculation, which is all evolution is, theory and speculation. And if you took evolution into the courtroom, you couldn't get to first base. Courts, rules of evidence, require that we have facts, that these facts be provable. You've got to be able to present witnesses, names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence. Now, the narrative here produces names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence of a worldwide flood. So let's take a look here at the basic arguments for a universal flood. The depth of the flood is number one. Write that down. The depth of the flood is proof number one. Out of seven here. Here comes number one. One of the most important biblical arguments for a universal flood is the statement in Genesis 7, verses 19 and 20, where it says, and the waters prevailed exceedingly upon the earth, and all of the high mountains that were under the whole heaven were covered. Did you get that? All of the high mountains that were under the whole heaven were covered. And here's how deep. 15 cubits they were covered. It didn't just cover it. It covered it to a depth of 22 feet. 15 cubits. Now, one need not be a professional scientist to realize the tremendous implications of these biblical statements. Because if only one, to say nothing of all of the high mountains, had been covered with water, then the flood would have been absolutely universal. Because water must seek its own level, and it must do so quickly. And Herbert C. Leupold makes the following statement concerning the exegesis and the interpretation of this crucial text of Scripture. He said, quote, a measure of the waters is now made by comparison with the only available standard for such waters, and that is the mountains. And they are said to have been covered. Not merely a few, but all of the high mountains under all of the heavens. Now, one of these expressions alone would almost necessitate the impression that the author intends to convey the idea of the absolute universality of the flood. For example, all of the high mountains. And yet, since all is known to be used in a relative sense, the writer removes all possible ambiguity by adding the phrase, under all of the heavens. That's a double all. And KOL cannot allow for so relative a sense, and it almost constitutes a Hebrew superlative. So we believe that the text disposes of the question of the universality of the flood. Okay, now there's number one. Number two, the duration of the flood, the length of it. How long did this flood last? Well, a careful study of the biblical data reveals the fact that the flood lasted for 371 days. That's a little over 1 year. And that the flood continued for more than a year is entirely in keeping with the doctrine of its worldwide or universality, but cannot properly be reconciled with the local flood theory. While there may be a difference of opinion among Christian scholars as to the depth or the general depth of the flood, depending upon the altitude of the antediluvian mountains, there can be no question as to its duration. And let's pause here for a moment and think about this for a second. 371 days long. Can you name one local flood? The Amazon, the Nile, the Mississippi, the Tigris and Euphrates. Name one that lasted 371 days. Huh? Now, I come from a floodplain in the Eel River Valley of California, and I've been through three big floods. Three. And never did a flood last a year. You know, we have a thing called summer. You have a rainy season and you have a dry season. And when the rains stop, the flood goes away in about a week, and all the water drains off of the land. Water, boys and girls, in case you live in the city and you haven't observed this eyeball to eyeball, water runs downhill. That's one of the first things that we plumbers learn. You know, water runs downhill, and payday is on Friday. So let's wake up here and smell the coffee. Water does not stay on the land. It runs off. When it rains, the water rains onto the highest elevation of land, and then it runs down the high elevation of land into little creeks. The creeks run into the rivers, and the rivers run into the ocean. That's what you're observing. And so the water runs off of the land. Now, how long does it take the water to run off of the land? Well, if we had water on the whole earth, it might take a year for it to run off. But I can't think of a single one. You write me a letter now and tell me if you know of or if you've heard of a flood, a local flood. Local, meaning like the Mississippi River Valley of 1993. We had a big flood here. Lasted for about, I don't know, a month or two. It was a long, drawn-out flood. Rained and rained and rained. Did it last a year? It lasted 2 or 3 months, and that was a long, drawn-out flood. All right. Next item over here. The geology of the flood. This is number three. What is the geology? Since so many arguments against the universal flood have been based upon supposed geological objections, it's very important to realize that the scriptures have something to say about the geological factor also. In fact, the first recorded event of the flood is that on the same day were all of the fountains of the great deep broken up. That's in Genesis 7, verses 11. All of the fountains of the great deep were broken up. Now, according to Brown, Driver, and Briggs, the word Rome, that is T-E-H-O-M, tome, translated deep in this verse, has a primary meaning. The first, deep, a subterranean water, two, sea, and three, primeval ocean deep. Now there can be little question then that the phrase T-E-H-O-M, R-A-B-B-A-H, great deep, points back to the T-E-H-O-M of Genesis 1 verse 2 and refers to the ocean depths and underground reservoirs of the antediluvian world. Presumably then, the ocean basins were fractured and then uplifted sufficiently to pour waters over the continents. In conjunction with those waters, which were above the firmament and which poured down through the windows of heaven. Now the close connection that exists between Genesis 7:11 and Genesis 1 verses 2 through 10 must be evident to all who have studied the text with any care. For example, Franz Dlitz, D-E-L-I-T-Z-S-C-H, Dlitz, I guess that's pronounced, calls our attention to the fact that it was by a cooperation of subterranean and celestial forces which broke through the restraints placed upon the waters on the second and third days of the creation, and the deluge was brought to pass. But the most significant fact to be observed is that these geological phenomena were not confined to a single day. In fact, the scriptures state that this breaking up of the fountains of the great deep continued for a period of 5 months, because it was not until after the 150 days had passed that the fountains of the deep were stopped. That's in Genesis 8, verse 2. Now, such a vast and prolonged geologic upheaval in the ocean depths cannot be reconciled with the theory that the flood was merely a local inundation in some part of the Near East. Instead, this biblical information gives substantial support to the concept that a geographically universal deluge is taking place here. All right, now, for the sake of those of you, you know, who are skeptics, we're not here arguing the truth or the veracity of the biblical statements being made here. We haven't got to that point yet. That's what we call assuming facts, not an evidence. Assuming facts, not an evidence. What we're doing here is presenting evidence that the biblical statement offers a third alternative to this three-part question. The question is this. Was there a flood that was worldwide in scope? And of course, the skeptics say, no, there wasn't. So, was there a flood of worldwide scope? There's a group of people say, well, yes, there was. And so now we have what we know as a contested issue of fact. The contested issue of fact is, was this flood worldwide or was it not? A third group of people come into the equation and they say, well, there was a flood, all right. But the flood wasn't worldwide, the flood was local. And that's what we're zeroing in on right here. This third group, the flood was local, is what I'm taking issue with. So, okay, let's just entertain that theory for a minute. Do these statements lend any evidence to your mind that this flood is local? If it does, stick with it. I'm not here to persuade you that it wasn't. This thing of trying to persuade people or trying to convince them is actually a waste of time. And it wastes your time. It's like the old adage that says, it's like trying to teach a pig to sing. And they waste your time and it annoys the pig. Now, not everybody can grasp the significance of this. I mentioned this the other day. We're talking about this thing of belief. What is it that makes you believe what you believe? And so I said, 25% of everything that comes out of your mouth is false. It's not false because you're trying to deceive people. It's false because you have already been deceived. You already believed something that wasn't true, and now you're disseminating it to other people. Now, is this a phenomenon that occurs among all people everywhere all the time? And as far as we've been able to determine, that's exactly correct. Now, judges, prosecutors, and lawyers all know this. It's a closely guarded secret, and you're not supposed to know this. And the guy that discovered it was Professor Swift back in 1918 in one of his psychology classes, and he started testing people's memories to find out whether or not they could remember something for a period of time. This is the eyewitness testimony. And the answer is no. So I told you the story about the boat and the four adults and four children who were out here, and with two cameras sitting here taking pictures from both sides. Now watch what happens here. At the end of the 60 minutes, and this is the story that I observed. At the end of the 60 minutes, the people that are taking the test are given a questionnaire, 100 questions, and asked to fill it out. And then they fill it out. And remember that this is a rehearsed event. The actors are all staged. They all do their job. They all do what they're supposed to do. The boat, you know, has got a color. The boat has got an inboard or an outboard motor on it. And the actors, there's two men and two women, and then there's four children. And of course, questions come up. What was the sex of the four children? What was the color of the boat? What kind of a motor did the boat have on it? And these aren't multiple choice questions, you know, where they actually give you the answer. See, a multiple choice question, your chances of getting a multiple chance question correct is 25% coming out of the chute. And it doesn't test your memory. What tests your memory is, what kind of a motor did it have? And so you're going to answer, well, it had an outboard motor. What kind of an outboard motor was it? Well, it was a Yamaha. What was the horsepower? It was a Yamaha 65 horse. Now, when we actually test these people, no, it was an Evinrude 35, not a Yamaha 65. Or in some cases, it'll be an inboard, not an outboard. You can ask the question this way. Now, what was the brand name of the outboard motor on the boat? And they'll ask that question when the test is being given and it's got an inboard motor. And this is called the power of suggestion. What we do is we suggest to you. And then you're going to make a mistake here because this boat has an inboard motor. It's not outboard. But we suggest to you, by making the question this way, we say, what was the brand name on the outboard motor? Is that deceptive? It's testing your powers of observation. Let me give you an illustration. One time I was in a courthouse up in Webster County. I was in the sheriff's office, and the sheriff had me down on the floor, and he had his boot on top of my head, applying pressure with two deputies on top of me. One of them twisting my arm behind my back, and the other one putting his elbow into my rib cage. During this exercise, I yelled out, "No, no, don't beat me anymore." Now, unbeknownst to me, right at this moment of time, my wife was standing outside the sheriff's office. Now, this was the booking room adjacent to the sheriff's office, the main door. And there was a door there with a window in the door which was covered by Venetian blinds. During this event, one of the deputies evidently hit the Venetian blind on the door and knocked it loose on one side, making the view from the outside, that is the hall, looking into the booking room in the sheriff's office, visible to the people out in the hall. Now my wife is standing there with two court reporters. And my wife gasped and said, "Oh my God, look at the blood." All right, now listen to that statement. "Oh my God, look at the blood." Now, there wasn't any blood. Remember, I'm the victim. And I can testify that there wasn't any blood. Now, if there was some blood there, now, I'm not going to say there wasn't any. There could have been. I didn't see any. I'm a witness there. I was present. And I can testify it wasn't my blood. That's not to say that somebody else didn't cut his finger and there was blood, or cut his arm off in the process and there was blood everywhere. Now, get this. The two court reporters who saw this event, which was probably pretty traumatic for these two ladies. They'd probably never seen somebody being beat up before. And so they came into court when this thing went to trial, and they testified, both of them testified, there was blood everywhere. And they used that word, there was blood everywhere. That's the power of suggestion. There wasn't any blood anywhere. But they had heard the words, "Oh my God, look at the blood." And it registered on their subconscious mind. Later, when they tried to recall this event under oath, on the witness stand, having raised their hands, swore to God himself, there was blood everywhere. Well, there wasn't any of my blood anywhere. And then I didn't see any blood there. When I testified, I said, I never got cut. I wasn't bleeding. And let me tell you, it was to my best interests to have blood everywhere. And I was hoping that they would have lacerated me to show the police brutality. But that didn't happen. That wasn't the fact of the case. Now, what this does is it demonstrates that once you have impressed upon somebody's mind a fact that they actually believe, they will repeat that fact, as erroneous as that fact may be. There was a fact to be discerned here in that courtroom that day. Was there any blood? How much blood? And whose was it? So I testified. There wasn't any blood that I saw. And it wasn't my blood. So therefore, there wasn't very much of it. These two ladies said there was blood everywhere. Were they lying? They weren't committing perjury, but they were lying, but they actually believed the lie that they were disseminating. That's why it wasn't perjury. They believed it. So this is why when people have a belief, like, you know, a Catholic, you can back off here, you Baptists out there. You're not going to convert this guy. His mind's already made up. Mormons can see Mormon philosophy as clear as a bell. But you have a problem as a Baptist, and you're shaking your head saying, how can these fools be that deceived? The evolutionist is looking at the religionist and says, these people are lunatics. These people are nuts. But hey, you evolutionists out there, the Baptist, honest to God, he believes every word of it. Of course it's nonsense, but, you know, he believes that. Now, the religious guy over here, he looks at you evolutionists and he says, my God, can't you people see? And to him, it's just as clear as a bell. He can just see Jesus, you know, up in heaven doing whatever they see him doing. Now, these are perceptions that in the courtroom we have to cut through. I mean, the judge and the prosecutor and the jury and everybody. This is why we have these rules of evidence. There's 188 of them, by the way, in just case you were wondering. It's 188 rules of evidence. We're going to apply the six basic rules that apply to parole evidence or testimonial evidence here. This is what we're trying to do. And then there are 23 modalities or tests or triggers that we use in cross-examination in order to come up to the truth. And sometimes they're a little tricky. That's why we ask questions like, can you tell us what the brand name on the outboard motor was, even though it wasn't an outboard motor, it was an inboard motor, to test your powers of observation. This requires you then to say, there wasn't an inboard motor, it was a Yamaha 65. Okay. All right, now, number four, the size of the arc. This arc had a pretty significant size to it. And the size of the arc now is one more piece of evidence here that dispels this concept of a local flood. But before we get to that, let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now that's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse will necessarily reciprocate. Now, keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and editorial review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our website at georgegordon.org or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about modern science and Noah's Ark. Modern science and Noah's Ark. We are reviewing these seven proofs, seven pieces of evidence here that would tend to indicate that this flood was universal in scope. So we've taken a look at the depth of the flood. It covered all of the high mountains. That is not indicative of a local flood. The geology of the flood talks about the fountains of the great deep being broken up for 150 days. That does not bode well for a local flood in the Eel River Valley or in the Nile Valley. Number three. The second one was the duration of the flood was a year, 371 days. A flood that lasts 371 days, boys and girls, is something bigger than any local flood that's ever occurred on planet Earth. Well, at least in historic times where we've got any records of them. And then number four, the size of the ark. And that's where we're at, where we are located right now. The size of this ark. Now, according to Genesis 6, verse 15, Noah was commanded to make the length of the ark 300 cubits, the breadth 50 cubits, and the height 30 cubits. So the first question that we need to consider here, of course, is the length of a cubit, as it's used in this passage. Now, the Babylonians had a royal cubit of 19.8 inches. The Egyptians had a longer and a shorter cubit of 20.65 inches and 17.6 inches. And the Hebrews apparently had a long cubit of 20.4 inches that we see in Ezekiel 40, verse 5, and a common cubit of about 17.5 inches. So as we can see here, the cubit then ranges from somewhere between 17.5 inches to 20.65 inches. You know, it's pretty close, 17.5 to 20.5. It's within 3 inches. But 3 inches times 300 feet long, you know, would be 900 inches, you know, from the shortest to the longest in round numbers. Well, 900 inches over here, let's just try this out, 900 divided by 12, would be 75 feet. So, in order to come to a conclusion, we really don't know the exact size of the ark, unless we had the remains of it, then we could go out there with a tape measure and measure it up. But we don't need to have the ark to figure it out. We can look at history and we can come to a conclusion. We can come up with the smallest possible size of the ark is going to be 17.5 inches to the cubit, and the longest, the biggest possible ark is going to be 20.65. Now, while it's certainly possible that the cubit referred to in Genesis 6 was longer than 17.5 inches, for the purposes of our discussion, we shall take the shorter cubit as the basis for our calculations. Now, according to this standard, the ark was 437.5 feet long, 72.92 feet wide, and 43.75 feet high. Now, it had three decks, as we see in Genesis 6, verse 16. So, it had a total deck area of 95,700 square feet, which is equivalent to more than the area of 20 standard college basketball courts. And its total volume was 1,396,000 cubic feet. The gross tonnage of the ark, which is a measurement of cubic space rather than weight, 1 ton in this case being equivalent to 100 cubic feet of usable storage space, was about 13,960 tons, which would place it well within the category of large metal ocean-going vessels today. So, let's take a look at these large ocean-going ships today. A 10,000-ton ship is a big boat. That is one whale of a big ship, 10,000 tons. This ark was 13,960 tons, or about 14,000 tons. If you look at the Titanic, it was 40,000 tons, or not quite, but approaching four times larger than Noah's Ark. This is the Titanic. Big ship. Aircraft carriers weigh 100,000 tons. And there are some oil tankers, you know, to give you an idea of how big an oil tanker is. There are oil tankers out there that are 100,000, 250,000, and I think there's one or two 500,000 tons. At least I heard talk about building 500,000 ton ships in my lifetime. Whether they actually did so or not, I don't know. But I heard of a couple of them that are 250,000 tons. Now, those are big boats. Now, the Ark wasn't as big as these super tankers or aircraft carriers by any stretch of the imagination, but it was a big ship. It's not little. Now, remember the story of the two court reporters that testified, "Oh, my God, there's blood everywhere." Let me show you how this works. It's called the power of suggestion. The most common objection to Noah's flood is that the ark isn't big enough. And so when we ask people the question, well, how big was the ark? They don't know. But they know it wasn't big enough. It wasn't big enough for what? wasn't big enough to haul all those animals. How many animals did we need to put in the ark? And they don't know. Now, these people are honest and they're sincere and they mean well, but they have an objection. They have in their minds, they have this objection. The ark is too small to haul all those animals. And where did they get the idea that the ark was too small? Every picture, boys and girls, think about it now. Every picture you have ever seen of this ark shows a boat that is overcrowded with elephants and giraffes, hippopotamuses. All of the biggest animals on planet Earth are on this ark, and it's way too small. You have never seen a picture of the ark, a humongous ship with a mouse scurrying around on top of it. And so it's a matter of perception. And your perception from the time you were a little child, when you got your first coloring book called Noah's Ark. I remember when I was a little kid, I got a coloring book called Noah's Ark. And here was this little boat with these great big animals, and the animals are so big, and the boat is so small, that their heads are sticking out the windows. And they're standing way up, bigger. The elephant standing on the top deck of the ark, as I can recall it now from my memory, when I was a little kid. The elephants were at least half the size of the ark that they were standing on. And so, of course, in my mind, I've got these great big animals, elephants, giraffes, hippopotamuses, rhinoceroses, on the deck of a ship that's too small. And so the impression that you have is that this size of the ark is too small. It's what you've always seen all your life. You saw it in the Sunday school lesson. You saw it in your coloring books. And whenever anybody is depicting a cartoon of Noah's Ark and a flood or something like that, that's the perception that you get. Is that perception true or false? Okay, now let's go on. Now, while it is certainly possible that the cubit referred to in Genesis 6 was longer than 17 and a half inches, to be conservative now, we're going to take the smaller cubit. Well, Arthur Custance questions whether the ark could really have been this huge, and he suggests, without any evidence, that the cubit of those days may have been much shorter than 18 inches. And then he goes on to say, I think anyone who tries to visualize the construction of a vessel 450 feet long by four men will realize that the size of the timbers alone for a building 45 feet high, which is analogous to a four-story apartment building, would seem by their sheer massiveness to be beyond the powers of four men to handle. Now, with all the means later at their disposal, subsequent builders for 4,000 years constructed seaworthy vessels that seldom seem to have exceeded 150 to 200 feet at the most. The Queen Mary has a total length of 1,018 feet, which is not very much more than twice the length of the Ark, and it wasn't until 1884... apparently, that a vessel, the Etruria, a Cunard liner, was built with a length exceeding that of the ark. All right, now that was Arthur Custance. All right, now what's wrong with his argument here? The testimony of the scripture does not say that four men built the ark. Read it for yourself. Let's write that down. In Genesis 6, 7, and 8, it does not give us the size of the workforce that built the ark. It tells us how long it took, or it told us how long he was given to build it. We don't know if Noah built the ark in 80 years or 120. I read the text. It did not tell us. We did not get from the observer, the witness, the guy that made the affidavit, did not tell us the size of the workforce. Now, what we call this in law is assuming facts, not in evidence. And Arthur Custance comes to a conclusion. He says, well, this ship is 450 feet long, and four men couldn't build it. I don't know what four men could do in 120 years when it comes to building that ark. I don't have a clue. It is a pretty formidable task, but 120 years is a long time. Now, he says the building beams would be too big. I don't know. How big do the building beams have to be? I'm a general contractor, and right off the top of my head, I don't know. I would imagine 8x8, maybe even 16x16-foot beams. I can't imagine a 16x16-foot beam, but I guess we might have to make some 16x16-foot beams. Those are about like logs. I know that four men and a team of horses can move logs that are 16 inches in diameter. That's no big deal. And to think that we have to pick these up manually by brute force without the use of levers and pulleys or simple machines, that's not true. Men have been logging and cutting beams and boards and building big buildings for thousands of years, boys and girls. I find that it's a big undertaking. I don't doubt it. But who's to say that Noah didn't have a workforce in his shipyard of 100 or 200 or 300 men working on that ark? And who's to say that when he started building the ark that he didn't start in the 95th year and work to the 115th year and build the ark in 20 years? I don't know. The text doesn't tell us. Now, when you don't have direct evidence, to come to these kinds of conclusions is called assuming facts not in evidence. It's outside the scope of the rules of evidence. We can't make these kinds of assumptions. We have to step up to the plate and say, I don't know. I don't know. Now, if I saw a guy out here and we were talking about an engineer and you said to me, this guy, Bob over here, built this airplane. This airplane is a Piper Cub. It weighs about 1,500 pounds. And it has an 85 horsepower engine in it. I would look at the airplane, I would look at Bob, and I would say, yeah, that makes sense. I think I could see that. Now you come to him, you say, now this guy Bob over here is an aircraft engineer, and he built the 747. And you take me out and you show me the 747, I'd say, wow. I mean, hell, the tail's up there 3, 4, 5 stories. I forget how high that tail is. 50 feet off the ground, 5 stories, I think it is. I mean, that's big. Now, would I say to you, well, this guy, Bob, could not possibly have built that 747? You know, I don't know what Bob could or could not do, and I don't know whether Bob could build that thing by himself or not. I'm not very confident in my own ability to build a 747 by myself, or maybe with one, two, or three other men. But then, who's to say that Bob, the engineer, didn't build it through the aid of the Boeing company, and they built the ship, or built the airplane, with a workforce of 300 men? We get to the point where we start assuming these facts. We come up with objections. Well, objections aren't proof. An objection, boys and girls, is merely your opinion. Nothing more and nothing less. Now, in court, we're required to stick with the facts. Just the facts. What do we know and what is it that we don't know? And sometimes we come up with what we call a hung jury. We were unable, with the facts that were presented, to come to a conclusion. We just, you know, we don't know. We don't know if this guy's guilty or not. We're unable to figure that out. Now, most times we can. Most of the time we take all of the relevant facts. If the lawyers do their job, then they get the witnesses scoped out, and we get all these facts. 12 people typically can sit back and say, okay, we'll put all this together. Based upon what we know, here's the conclusion we come to. The scriptures, however, do not suggest that Noah and his three sons had to construct the ark without the help of hired men. Nevertheless, we agree that the sheer massiveness of the ark staggers the imagination, and in fact, this is the very point of our argument. Because Noah, to have built a vessel of such magnitude simply for the purpose of escaping a local flood is inconceivable. The very size of the ark should effectively eliminate the local flood view from serious consideration among those who take the book of Genesis at face value. Now let's think about this. Back in 1993, we had a big flood here in the Mississippi Valley, which borders Missouri here. And it was a long flood. Hell, it lasted for 2 or 3 months. Started way up in the headwaters, or not the headwaters, but way up the Missouri River in South Dakota. And then flowed on down the Missouri into the Mississippi River and flooded the river on down, way below St. Louis. And the flood lasted for a long time. I forgot exactly, but 60, 80 days. But the flood wasn't over all of the land for 60 or 80 days. It was rising slowly and getting deeper and deeper and deeper. And then as the waters went down the river, they kept rising and rising. And then they blew out some dikes and dams, and levees, and flooded a lot of real estate. Boys and girls, nobody built an ark the size of an ocean-going ship to escape that flood. I mean, it's preposterous on its face. So for Noah to build a ship of that size, whether it was big enough to hold all those animals or not, would of and by itself tell you that this guy was preparing for something bigger than a flood down the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. Just your common sense ought to tell you that. And this is one of the factors that we take in parole evidence. We take the experience of the witnesses. We take their intelligence. And we take the experience of all of us, and we listen to the story. And I come to you and I say, there was a big flood in the Mississippi Valley, and so old Bob over here built a 14,000-ton ship to escape the floodwaters. And he took in a lot of animals so that they wouldn't be destroyed from out of the Mississippi Valley. We took on white-tailed deer by 7 and 7 so that we could keep seed alive up and down the Mississippi Valley from Louisiana to South Dakota. Because if we hadn't done that, the white-tailed deer would have been eradicated. Come on, kids, let's wake up and smell the coffee here. White-tailed deer are all over America. And if you killed every deer from South Dakota to New Orleans, every single deer, they're all dead. In 20 or 30 years, they'd all be repopulated again because they'd come in from Tennessee and North Dakota and from all around, and they would repopulate that region just as soon as the waters go down and the grass grows. Every time you have a local flood and we don't have a big ark and it wipes out all the deer and the cattle and everything there, how long does it take for it to repopulate? You had a big fire up in Yellowstone Park, back here in the 80s. Remember that? Big fire up there. And it destroyed vast regions of the park. Did they build a big ark up there to save seed alive and so that the grizzly bears wouldn't be exterminated and the buffalo, wouldn't become extinct? I mean, just common sense comes into play here, doesn't it? Now, number 5 deals with the need of the ark. Why do we even need this thing? The need for an ark. Not only would an ark of such gigantic proportions have been unnecessary for a local flood, but there would have been no need for an ark at all. The whole procedure for constructing such a vessel, involving over a century of planning and toiling simply to escape a local flood, can hardly be described as anything but utterly foolish and unnecessary. Now, listen, can you see why the evolutionary school of thought over here laughs with derision upon you religious people out here trying to promote this local flood theory, trying your hardest over here to reconcile the Bible with evolutionary philosophy? You know, the position that the Bible takes is that it was a worldwide flood, and the evolution guy says, we don't believe it. The fact that the evolution guy doesn't believe it proves nothing. Absolutely nothing. Whether I believe something or not is irrelevant and immaterial. I believe the world is flat. So what? You believe the world is round. Your belief that the world is round doesn't make it round, and my belief that the world is flat doesn't make it flat. Belief doesn't prove jack diddly squat. Now, it may just so happen that your belief is correct and mine is an error. But our beliefs have nothing to do with the truth or the veracity of the matter. That's the bottom line. So let's come around here and take a look. Well, what could you bring into court? And, you know, when you people come into court here with this local flood theory, the depth of the flood, the duration of the flood, the geology of the flood, the size of the ark, and the need for the ark. There isn't any need for an ark in a Mississippi flood. Listen, the Nile River has been flooding for thousands of years. Nobody's ever built an ark to save the animals and the flora and the fauna alive down there. That's ridiculous. And to take such a position just holds you up to ridicule. And that's why when I read this section here in The Harmony of Science and Scripture, Harry Rimmer is so logical and such a good writer and such a good scientist. When I read that kind of thing, I just got to shake my head and say, where is this guy's brain? What happened on that day when he wrote that chapter? What was he thinking about? It runs counter to the text, which, by the way, is the third alternative here. Instead of just having two alternatives, you know, if you believe the world is round, and I believe the world is flat, has it occurred to you that we could both be wrong, and that the world could have some different configuration, like maybe being a box or a rectangle? You know, just because you've been presented with two alternatives over here doesn't mean that either one of those alternatives is correct. There could be a third, a fourth, or a fifth alternative which could be true, which would make both you and I wrong. Has it ever occurred to us that maybe both of us are in error here, and that there is some third or fourth answer here? All right, so that's the need for the ark. Now listen, we got to have some witnesses here. I'm out of time, so we'll take this up next time. And we'll take a look at number 6 and 7, the testimony of other witnesses to this transaction. Were there any other witnesses that could testify to this? And the answer to that is yes, there is. But we'll take that up next time. Meanwhile, back here on the farm, you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, it's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.